You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of August 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Guy Delaney.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with Raffaello Pantucci of the Royal United Services Institute. Raffaello, what do you have for us?
Well, this morning we're going to be talking about the US suspending its summit with Russia. We're going to talk a bit more about this Al-Qaeda plot in Yemen. And then we're going to talk about Bo Xilai, the currently incarcerated Chinese dissident, some people who have been protesting about him online.
Excellent stuff. Also on the program, some Swiss towns are trying to ban asylum seekers from public spaces. We'll ask if the most neutral country of Europe is also the most racist one.
Also ahead, we will find out why, in the name of all that is holy, Hollywood studios are turning to musical theatre.
For very little money, maybe $10 million, you can develop a movie into a musical. Now, that's $10 million compared to what the cost of a Hollywood movie can be.
Yes, Guy will be defying gravity later in the program. Also, get ready to ditch your t-shirt and jeans and get into those Speedos and bikinis, because we're all going to be going for a swim.
All that, plus we'll check in with our correspondent in Bamako, we'll read through the Turkish front pages, and we'll even play some music, real music this time. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So lots to come in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. But before all that, here is David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. The United States and Europe have warned of a dangerous stalemate in Egypt after international talks on the political crisis collapsed. The country's military rulers have announced an end to international mediation and warned the Muslim Brotherhood it will be held responsible for any further violence. Supporters of Egypt's deposed president, Mohamed Morsi, have vowed to protest today, with rival groups also holding demonstrations. More than 200 people have died in violence since Morsi was ousted, and Fawaz Jerjes from the London School of Economics, who's an expert on the region, fears more deaths are likely.
It's not just about civilian casualties, it's about the fact what will happen now is that we'll deliver a hard blow to the fragile democratic experiment in Egypt.
A public commemoration is taking place in Burma to mark the 25th anniversary of the student uprising that eventually led to the country's pro-democracy movement. The new government, which has promised wide-ranging reforms, has allowed veterans of the 1988 uprising to join events in Rangoon to mark the occasion. International flights have resumed at the main airport in the Kenyan capital Nairobi after Wednesday's devastating fire. It took 5 hours to bring under control and caused huge delays for air traffic across much of Africa. Investigations into the cause of the fire are continuing. Inspections of facilities at the world's largest dairy exporter are continuing after a major food safety scare. New Zealand food safety regulators have been examining Fonterra's processing plants after it admitted at the weekend that it had sold whey protein products that contained a bacteria which can cause botulism. The company said it has launched 2 separate investigations into the incident and how it handled it. Chairman John Wilson has been speaking at a news conference in Auckland.
I need to say how deeply concerned we are in Fonterra for the anxiety that has been created by this precautionary recall that has been carried out by Fonterra. On behalf of Fonterra, I want to apologise to the mums, the dads and the caregivers for any confusion that has been created over the last 4 or 5 days.
Former US President Bill Clinton has praised South Africa's anti-retroviral campaign to treat AIDS and HIV, calling it the largest in the world. Clinton and his daughter Chelsea are in the country visiting some of the Clinton Health Access Initiative projects across 5 African countries. One of them is just outside Pretoria, where 2,500 patients are seen every month with HIV and TB counselling and testing provided. Mr. Clinton said it was a difficult but important challenge to face.
There are too many people in the world and in this country who have both AIDS and tuberculosis. And their lives, even if they are saved, become miserable unless they are tested and get the medicine.
An independent review of Chile's census last year has found that it failed to take into account nearly 10% of the population. A panel has looked into the report and recommends the results be annulled, saying that the mistakes occurred because many people were not at home or homes were wrongly labelled as empty. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Well, thank you very much indeed, David. How would you run a census, David?
I would make sure if I knocked on someone's door and they didn't answer that maybe they were just away at that particular occasion.
You would have thought, wouldn't you, Phil, that they'd have protocols for that sort of thing?
I would think so, yeah. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But I'm not very good at math, so I think after a couple door knocks, I'd lose track.
Well, David Spencer with the news there and census advice for all. It's now coming up to 7 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monocle, 26 Cheche.
From London,
London. London, Caracas.
This is Monocle
24. And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. It's time now to set the day's news agenda with the three stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute here in London joins us this morning in the studio. Raffaello, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Are we upon a second Cold War? What's happening?
On the basis of the front pages today, we are. And we've got the Americans and the Russians facing off again. We've spoken about this a few times in the past few weeks. This sort of Edward Snowden business, his decision to finally first go to China and then Russia raised a lot of eyebrows. And the fact that now the Russians have decided to give him asylum as though he's a political dissident, sort of fleeing, sort of persecution in some way, rather than the Americans would see it, which would be a criminal who has sort of betrayed state secrets and, you know, broken the Official Secrets Act or whatever they have in the States. This has sort of been the straw that's broken the camel's back from President Obama's perspective. He's decided, you know, enough is enough. I don't want to have a bilateral meeting with President Putin now, because clearly our relations are not moving in a space that we can have a sort of productive discussion. I would emphasize this doesn't mean that we're having a complete severing of relations here. They're still having sort of working level meetings, and the president is still going to go to the St. Petersburg G20 summit. But he's not going to do the bilateral afterwards, which is what one traditionally does. You sort of visit the country in the sort of multilateral format, and then you do the bilateral one on the side. And I mean, there's a whole raft of issues sort of behind this.
The thing is as well, Raffaello, we tend to see this being in Western Europe as we are, and with the United States being an ally of the United Kingdom. We tend to see things through a United States prism, if you like. But looking at it from Russia's point of view, well, the United States has hardly covered itself in clover in this issue. It's intercepted or attempted to intercept, did intercept, in fact, flights which took off from Russia's Moscow airport. It has been putting its nose into Russia's internal affairs, telling it what it should do. Had there been any suggestions from Russia that it should be the one to call off the summit?
No. I don't think I'll be very quick there. No, I don't think we have heard that from the Russian side at all. At the end of the day, from Russian perspective, you know, they want to be seen as the big player at the table. I mean, this kind of serves that purpose as well, to be honest. You know, being the sort of obstructionist is as good as being the sort of constructive player, if you're going to do it in the sort of PR terms. But no, I mean, I think the point is that the Russians and the Americans have seen. I think the Snowden issue, I think the hacking thing is not really at the root of this, to be honest. I think that's just a sort of
accumulation of a whole series of different things. I mean, the Russians aren't being very helpful on Syria, for example, where the Americans would like to see a more productive outcome. On Iran, we've seen a whole series, you know, the sort of nuclear program there chugs on. We've seen recent sort of anti-democratic moves in Russia, the sort of decision to ban gay athletes from Sochi or something. I can't remember the exact details of that element of it, but there's a whole series of issues that from an American perspective is seen as quite angering. So I think that, you know, the hacking thing is part of a bigger picture in many ways. Now, you're right. From a Russian perspective, they say, you know, we don't think that intervention in Syria, for example, is going to lead to any sort of constructive outcome. And in fact, they probably find a lot of people here who would agree with that, to be honest. But I think it's the perception that Russia sort of sets itself up as the other side of the coin. You know, the Chinese have a tendency to sometimes do this as well, but they're a lot less sort of bold and brassy about it, if you will. The Russians are quite happy to sort of go out there and be, you know, oh, we're against this and this is why. The Chinese will sort of stand back and let it happen. And, you know,
and you mentioned Sochi there, of course, the 2014 Winter Olympics. And there is a growing movement, at least at the moment, for the Americans now to even consider boycotting those games. But I want to come back to President Obama. Do you think that him canceling this meeting is a missed opportunity? Because, you know, before Obama took the oath of the president, you know, he wanted to do business in a different way. Mm-hmm. It was all about doing international politics in a different way. He could have really went above the fray here and changed kind of the way things have been done, because this is really just a bit of tit and tat, isn't it?
I mean, it is. I think the American line would be, we have tried this. You know, Obama did come in, and you're right. There was this bigger reset. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember, you know, he presented a button. Hillary Clinton goes around a button to Sergei Lavrov. Turned out there was a mistranslation, but, you know, that aside. But they would say, we did a lot of things, like the sort of the renegotiation of the START Treaty, which is a big nuclear thing. They would say, we've done a lot of these things. We teed them up, but there was no sort of follow through. And they blame that on the Russians. Now, is it the Russians to blame? Is it the Americans for not being constructive here? I think it's probably a bit of both, frankly. But I think that, you know, President Obama, I think from their perspective, they think, you know, we've tried this before. We're now coming towards the end of the term. The end, you know, last few years of the Obama administration. This way you create the legacy. This is clearly not necessarily going to be a productive meeting. Why should we bother going to it?
Now, the Cold War was, of course, replaced a few years on, and suspiciously conveniently, one might argue, by the War on Terror. And we've got this, the details of this alleged Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula plot in Yemen, which the Yemenis government are saying they have unraveled. What's the truth in all this?
Well, I mean, the truth is, of course, very difficult to know, because this is sort of the whole world of intelligence and spycraft, and who knows what's really happening there. But I think the key thing to remember here is that this is the sort of, we're now getting the details are coming out about this big plot that has been sort of at the focus of international attention for the past week. Initially, we sort of revealed this with the Americans closing down a whole series of embassies, and then we slowly sort of focused it down in, and it turns out it was Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is Al-Qaeda's Yemeni affiliate, which is one of the more dangerous Al-Qaeda affiliates out there. They've repeatedly demonstrated capacity to launch some quite complicated attacks or attempted attacks against the West. But we're getting the details now from the Yemeni government, who are saying what was actually going to happen was they were going to take over some villages and they were going to try to blow up some pipelines. And to be honest, a lot of skepticism being thrown over these claims in particular. If this was really the sort of plot that was brewing, if you will, why was the reaction from the American intelligence community in a slightly different direction? These incidents are not new in Yemen, to be honest. I mean, pipelines are pretty regularly blown up by angry tribesmen or others. In terms of villages being taken over, AQAP had been pushed out of some of the cities it had held. It would make sense that they would try to come back and take them again. So it's not entirely clear if this is the whole picture we're getting. But I think the big thing is here that, you know, the plot and how it sort of played itself out, I think a lot of questions are being raised now about whether the American reaction was appropriate, what the real concern was. There was an odd story that emerged yesterday, which I see hasn't made many of the front pages today, which was saying that apparently the root of all the intelligence around this plot was a conference call, an Al-Qaeda conference call internationally with 20 different Al-Qaeda members sort of scattered around the world.
Were they using Google Hangouts?
Well, this is the question. And they figured, well, if they were using that, no one would have noticed, of course, right? You know, so this has emerged and now more details come out. I think that there's going to be a lot of questions asked in the wake of this plot. I think one about the sort of reaction and two about how the intelligence is being handled subsequently, because there's a lot of stuff which is leaking out, which probably shouldn't be leaking out. And it's not clear why it is or if people are doing this strategically or tactically to sort of, you know, besmirch someone. It's all very unclear. And now the Yemenis are putting out their story, which I think is very much in tune with what we'd expect them to say.
And of course, you could expect that if President Obama and his administration didn't overreach and take these precautions, that many people would have criticized him for that very fact. Let's briefly, though, Rafaela, move on to China. A Bolshe Lai supporter was just arrested for making some comments. He's a journalist, from what I understand, and he's just been arrested for his connection with this, Bolshe Lai.
Yes, this is a reporter called Song Yang Bao, who is a sort of famous, prominent sort of Bolshe Lai supporter online, who made some comments on Weibo, the sort of Chinese equivalent of Twitter, in which he was telling people to go and, you know, overrun the courtroom, you know, and to sort of help hijack this whole story. I think it was a couple of weeks ago now that it was sort of announced that Bolshe Lai was finally coming to trial. We're expecting it any day now, frankly. It's very difficult to know, you know, it could be that today's the day. we simply don't know. The Chinese are keeping this all very under wraps. What will probably happen is Bo will sort of show up. They'll basically read the charges out against him. He'll be convicted and then he'll get sent off. The question is, what happens with his sentence? Mm. Will it be a commuted life sentence, which is a commuted death sentence, which will be a life imprisonment? Or will it be an actual death sentence? This is a big question. I think the thing that this story raises is that, you know, he does have supporters out there. Mm. He was a very charismatic, popular guy in Chongqing. He focused a lot of his attention on getting, you know, public goods and other things improved there. And this, and some people like this, you know, they saw his sort of callback to sort of Maoist era as a sort of clarifying thing in a sort of confusing time.
My goodness, it's an interesting time, I think the Chinese would like to say. Thank you very much indeed, Raffaello. Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute.
Coming up after this very short break, we'll be heading to a Swiss town where asylum seekers are banned from public spaces.
Aspiring for greener cities and easier commutes, more and more people are switching to bikes. From Zurich to Toronto and on to Buenos Aires, we film pedal makers who've opened up artisanal bike shops to provide bespoke services for two-wheeled enthusiasts.
Frames are recycled and reworked, featuring Monochrome's minimalist design aesthetic. This bespoke upcycling has turned them into one of the Argentinian capital's greenest takes on transport.
Bike shops with a difference. In the film's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House, where the time is 8:17 here in London. It's 9:17 in Switzerland, and that's where we're heading next. Now, you may remember that time when Switzerland banned minarets, the tall spires atop Muslim mosques. Well, the country may well be once again accused of racism. This time, some small Swiss towns are planning to ban asylum seekers from public spaces like swimming pools, playing fields, libraries, and even churches.
Now, this move comes after the town of Bremgarten near Zurich opened a special center to house asylum seekers away from the general population. The Swiss government insists the rules aren't formal bans on movement, but it's admitted that its own Department of Immigration agreed the restrictions with local councils. Now, we're joined on the line by Alexandra Afonso, a lecturer in the Department of Political Economy at King's College London. Welcome, Alexandra.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. Our pleasure. Now, Switzerland has got these restrictions, which look awfully like a form of apartheid.
I think probably two things should be mentioned in the background of this particular case. So the first is that Switzerland grants quite extensive power to its local towns to decide to do whatever they want in a number of matters. Now, this particular ban on circulation of asylum seekers is one particular decision in this town of Bremgarten, which in no way be considered as a national policy. It's true that it's been agreed with the immigration services at federal level, but there is very little chance that this could stand a challenge in the Swiss Constitutional Court, for instance. And it is not the first time, actually, that local towns try to do strange things in terms of immigration. For instance, a few years ago, a town near Lützen tried to decide on naturalization decisions, so to grant Swiss citizenship to people through referendums, so people would get a booklet at home with a list of pictures, and they would have to decide whether they accepted the people to become Swiss or not. Now, this was ruled out as unconstitutional by the Constitutional Court, and it's pretty likely that this particular decision in Bremgarten couldn't stand a challenge in the Constitutional Court.
Let's just talk about some of those places where these asylum seekers will be banned. Public spaces like swimming pools, playing fields, libraries, churches. What's the main reasoning behind, not allowing these asylum seekers into places like churches? It just doesn't seem to make any sense.
Well, it is difficult to really understand what was in the mind of this local council in Switzerland, but it is true that Switzerland does accept a higher share of asylum seekers than many other countries in Europe. And typically, where to locate these centers for asylum seekers has been a subject of discussion and conflict between local towns and the federal government for a number of years. And, this does indeed, in a certain number of circumstances, create some local conflict, especially because Switzerland doesn't have many very big towns with few places. A center for asylum seekers with 150 people in a town of 1,000 people, it's possible that it's going to create some local conflicts and disturb the life of local people. Now, local councils are trying to find solutions to this possible conflict, and this is what they've come up with. I really doubt that this indeed could stand a challenge in the Constitutional Court.
But there does seem to be a staggering lack of sensitivity. If we take Raymond Tellenbach, who's the mayor of Bremgarten, he said, "We've decided on security grounds not to allow access to these areas to prevent conflict and guard against possible drug use." So you all, you asylum seekers, you're all great big druggies. We don't have any of those in Zurich.
Yeah, what should be considered in the background of this is also the strengthening of the Swiss People's Party, so the local extreme right party that has become the biggest political party in Switzerland, that has been really capitalizing on this idea that immigration is linked to drug trafficking. This is probably a manifestation of this kind of stereotype. Well, it is true that there has been a few cases of drug trafficking in centers for asylum seekers, which should be considered in the context of the restrictions actually that are set on the ability of these asylum seekers to work, since they cannot really seek proper employment, which is restricted for them. So often, in a certain number of cases, this has happened, that drug trafficking has happened in these centers.
Thank you very much for explaining the situation to us, Alexandra. Alexandra Afonso, lecturer at the Department of Political Economy at King's College London.
Now, lights, camera, action, darling. You like that?
Get
ready to get your jazz hands out, Guy, because Hollywood is celebrating the good old-fashioned musical. Well, movie producers are investing big on Broadway and the West End, hoping to turn some of that silver screen success into big dollars. We'll have a stroll or even a skip down Broadway, and you'll see a variety of Hollywood films up in all their sparkling glory that have been transformed into musicals, from Spider-Man to The Lion King and even Rocky, believe it or not.
There is, of course, a reason why this is happening. Just look at the Broadway hit Wicked. Or maybe, please don't. Universal Films is the major investor in the untold story of The Witches of Oz, and it's on track to become the most profitable venture in the company's entire 101-year history. But can Hollywood turn Broadway into a cash cow? Our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Patrick Healy, the New York Times reporter who's been looking into the topic.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz, I'm gonna...
My first question for you, Patrick. Why Hollywood studios are suddenly all over Broadway musicals?
Yeah, Hollywood studios are finding that Broadway is a great place to make money. They have brand name movies like Animal House and Billy Elliot, and they're finding that those movies open and sell well in America and overseas. And the DVD market has been declining in purchase sales, so they're looking for more ways to make money off of those brand name movies. And what they're finding is that for very little money, relatively, you know, maybe $10 million, you can develop a movie into a musical. Now, that's $10 million compared to what the cost of a Hollywood movie can be, which can be $100 million or $150 million. And the potential to make a lot of money off of a $10 million musical is real. Universal Studios has been making more money off of the musical Wicked than it made off of its top-grossing movies. It's just a huge moneymaker for that Hollywood studio, and other studios want to get in on the game.
Talking about Wicked, how can you turn a musical into a blockbuster?
It's interesting. It really goes to the creative team that you put together and what their vision is for the show. Wicked began as a novel that was a very kind of engrossing novel that kind of imagined the Wizard of Oz story, but from the point of view of the Wicked Witch of the West. And she was a very tortured, emotional, angry character who felt very misunderstood. And the way that the novel Wicked presented her is that she wasn't particularly evil or wicked. She was just so hated or misunderstood because of her green skin that she became this kind of radical creature. Though what the creative team of the Broadway musical came up with was they felt like that's the kind of complicated, dynamic character who would want to sing, who would have big emotions, big feelings, and would want to sing about them. So they created this story around the Wicked Witch of the West and her friendship with the Good Witch, Glinda, and they wrote a series of songs that have since become very popular. And in a way, they sort of very smartly tapped into the broad, wide interest that people have had for years in the Wizard of Oz story, and this was a way for people to sort of re-experience what they loved about the Wizard of Oz, but not just see the Wizard of Oz recycled on stage. I think there'd be less excitement for that. So this was sort of a new twist on it. So when Hollywood studios and artists from Broadway are looking at, for instance, turning the movie Tootsie into a musical, what they're thinking about right now is not just take the original Tootsie movie story that starred Dustin Hoffman and just plant it on stage, but instead come up with an entirely new story that may echo the original Tootsie movie, but come up with a new story so it feels fresh in the way that Wicked felt more fresh than just The Wizard of Oz.
It's interesting the range of films that they're planning to turn into musicals. There's a long list, including, I think, Fox wants to do The Devil Wears Prada, Waitress as well. Do you think all films can translate well when they become musicals?
Some have translated well and some have not. The movie to musical adaptations on Broadway that have failed tend to have a couple things in common. One is that the musicals are really similar to the original movie. In the cases of the Broadway musical Shrek and 9 to 5, they were essentially the exact same story of the movie Shrek, just with songs added to them. And what a lot of people found was that they didn't see the point of spending $120 buying a ticket to see the same story that they could just rent the DVD or buy the DVD for, you know, a few dollars. But the ones that seem to have been quite successful are movies like the last two Tony Award winners, which were Kinky Boots and Once. Those two musicals were based on movies, but the movies were not well known. They were critically well received, but they weren't big hits, and they were not seen as perfect movies. They were not seen as movies that you would say, why does anyone want to touch that or reinvent that? They were just these sort of little movies that not a lot of people saw, but that the Broadway artists saw the bones and skeleton of a story that could make a great musical.
You mentioned in your article as well, like, for example, the adaptation of Mrs. Doubtfire. I mean, it might be successful, but the film is so closely related to Robin Williams' performance that I think sometimes people might not want to see another actor playing Mrs. Doubtfire. Don't you think so?
That's exactly right. That's going to be a real hurdle for that show if it happens. With Shrek on Broadway, people loved from the Shrek movie the voices of Mike Myers as Shrek and Eddie Murphy as the donkey. And they went to the Broadway show and they felt, where's the Mike Myers voice? Where's the Eddie Murphy performance? They missed that.
Listen to me. Look, you love this woman, don't you?
Yes.
You want to hold her?
Yes.
Please.
Yes.
Then you got to try a little tenderness. The chicks love that romantic crap.
And finally, Patrick, I just want to ask you, do you sense like an upcoming backlash against this movie-turned-musical trend?
I don't sense a backlash. The trend has been going on in one form or another for decades. 80 years ago, the musicals on Broadway were based more on stories and books like Oklahoma and Showboat. Now they're based on movies. Maybe in 20 years they'll be based on television shows.
And that was Patrick Healy there from the New York Times speaking to our Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And at the top of the show, Guy, I promised our listeners that you'd be defying gravity. Are you going to defy gravity for us?
I'm currently spinning with indignation. Does that count?
You're not a fan, are you?
I'm not a fan, no.
Oh, well, I'll have to take you one of the shows here when you're in town. Well, I'll change your mind.
Thank you, Phil.
No problem.
I look forward to it. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll find out why Mali still doesn't have a president more than a week on from elections. And we'll get the headlines in the Turkish press. And what's more, we'll go for a swim in Zurich.
Pack your speedos. But first, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you. Rival protests have been called in Egypt as international talks on the political crisis collapsed. The United States and Europe have warned of a dangerous stalemate as the country's military rulers announced an end to international diplomacy. A public commemoration is taking place in Burma to mark the 25th anniversary of the student uprising. The new government, which has promised wide-ranging reforms, has taken part in events to mark the occasion. International flights have resumed at the main airport in the Kenyan capital Nairobi after Wednesday's devastating fire. Investigations into the cause are continuing, but officials say there is no indication of the fire being terrorist-related. A former director of the Brazilian Civil Aviation Agency and two TAM airline officials have gone on trial over the deaths of 199 people in a plane crash 6 years ago. They're accused of neglecting air transport safety by allowing the jet to land in heavy rain on the recently resurfaced runway in Sao Paulo. An independent review of last year's census in Chile has found that it failed to take into account nearly 10% of the population. A panel recommends the results be annulled. 15.8 million people were surveyed. It should have been closer to 17.4 million. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, David. David, we'll be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Guy Delaney. Now, this week, The Urbanist is enjoying summer in the city. And for this preview, we head to Switzerland. Zurich is undoubtedly known for its high quality of life, and enjoyment of the city is certainly at its apex in summer when you can run pell-mell from your office, strip off your suit and jump into the lake or the rivers, even on your lunch break. Sounds good.
There are plenty of cities which expand into their outdoor spaces and blossom with life in summer. But in Zurich, this unfolding also involves unpeeling, thanks to the strong Swiss bathing culture. Now, Berlin-based Monocle contributor Jessica Bridges' favourite summer city is Zurich, and she looks at one of its most valuable features and why cities with water should be taking advantage of it.
Life in the river and lake baths around Zurich is all-encompassing. And seemingly the whole city turns out on a hot sunny day for a swim or some sun sitting on the water. Thomas Maurer runs Body Enge, the hippest and most beautiful bath in the city, where on a recent visit even ex-Swiss National Bank chairman Philip Hildebrand was hanging out and eating a popsicle in this urban public space. Thomas explains more.
In summertime, during daytime, it's a public bath. They come for swimming, for tanning,
for hanging around, and also for the hospitality things we have here, like a bar, restaurant, and cultural events in the evening. And the bus is open until 8 o'clock in the evening, and then it's just an outdoor bar. We are on two floats built out of the lake, and we have a maximal capacity of people who can come in here. And we reach this capacity on nice weather every day. On Mietenkeer, that's a big road behind of our bus, actually, there are the big insurance companies in Zurich, like Swiss Re, Zurich Insurance Company, XXL. We call it the Versicherungsmeile. And they are coming from 12 to 1 just to have their business lunch, actually, and take a short swim and then go back to work. And we don't have so much kids in the bus, actually, because we don't have the beach. So you have to jump right into the water and you have to be able to swim when you come here. So for young children, it's maybe not the best place. We have other buses like Mietenkeer or Tiefenbrunn for that.
The special thing about Badi, the Swiss name for the baths, is the Swiss embrace of Badi and Badi culture. The Zurich Badi vary in offering and occupants, from family-friendly Mietenkeer with lawns and a sloping sand beach, to Seabed Enge, close to the heart of the Swiss insurance brokerages, crowded towel to towel with the young and beautiful, sipping white wine or proper American-style iced coffee. Wooden pontoon decks or sloping like sand provide easy entrance to the water.
I think this makes a lot out of the quality of the city of Zurich, actually, that you have the lake, and the lake is quite in the center of the city, or the city is built around the lake, that you have the possibility to be in the center, and in 2 or 3 minute times you can jump into the water and have a swim. This is really nice and special, and I don't see it in so many other cities, actually. That's one of the best things about Zurich, actually, is the lake.
Everyone from school kids abandoning clothes and backpacks to jump in the Limmat River, to business suit-clad workers on a quick sun-and-swim lunch break, the city goes Badi crazy. Some of these baths are even located on a channelized part of the Limmat River, offering a strong current for sporting, floating, and even a bit of excitement. The landscape architect, Stefan Rotzler, could be considered the River King of Zurich, with the extensive Lettenareal Bathing and Public Space project as just one of the many river works that his firm Rotzler Krebs has built in Zurich. A native of the city, he understands the soul of the rivers and the lake, and what you might want to bring with you on a visit.
Well, it's part of the everyday program of people there. Well, we are meeting on a swimming ground or bathing place. We are bringing the children, and many dogs are coming. And people bring their grills and invite friends and take their bicycles, make a bicycle ride to a bathing place. So there's a whole kind of culture hanging on this bathing thing. And in the evenings, of course, with the restaurants and all the food places around, people come, go to the rivers and to the lake and eat and drink and have fun, or smoke a little joint, or listen to music or make music. So this water thing really brings people together. That's interesting. In German, this is not so easy to be translated. The German word Soul, Seele, and lake is the same word. I don't know what it means. If you go into Sigmund Freud, he would explain you that all souls and the water of the rivers, Seele, they belong together. So that's, well, one of the grounds of our psyches and of our cultures.
Matthias Hug, principal of Meyerhaar Architekten, designed and remodeled Badi Enge, adding a sauna and hospitality facilities. Starting out as a lifeguard at Badi Enge, he got his firm off the ground with a remodel of the space as one of their first projects. His understanding of the bathing culture inspired his project to enhance the seasonal Badi culture as a way to escape hectic urban life.
It's what is the interesting part about Zurich, you know, this lake, and also the limit between the historical center of Zurich, so it's really important, and it's even more important nowadays because this this bathing culture, this health and being outside swimming, and that is one of the main reasons for the, I think, the living quality here in this town, and especially in summer. And even now, these different locations with this also activating these nice sites also in winter becomes even more interesting. This being close to a lake, overviewing a lake, is very has a high quality on your, I don't know, on your soul. It really gets you down from maybe from this like hectic of the town, and I think that's a quality.
While perhaps the wealth in Zurich helps the city to create and maintain these extraordinary swimming places, the added value of urban beaches as a city commodity is high. So high that many cities with still polluted waterways will dump sand next to the water and put out chairs using the power of suggestion in a waterfront beach fantasy. Where other cities must pretend, Zurich has an abundance of real not faux options. Growing interest in cleaning urban waterways or finding innovative urban swim solutions, like Berlin's barge pool or the New York Plus Pool experiment, suggest that maybe summer in the city near you will soon include actual swimming. Until then, for Monocle in Zurich, I'm Jessica Bridger.
And I wonder if the asylum seekers of Zurich are welcome in those urban waterways, Phil?
Yeah, it's a bit of an awkward subject, I think.
It's a juxtaposition there, yeah. An unfortunate juxtaposition.
There weren't any in Jessica Bridger's report, unfortunately.
Well, there we are. Yeah. That's the way things go. You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we're in Mali.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban when I was 26 years old, and I sort of just saved my money and went to photograph women living under the Taliban. And now I realize, wow, that was pretty dangerous.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
A fair at the end is on the one side a market platform, but I think especially here in Asia and in Southeast Asia, it should also be a place of an exchange, of a get-together.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24, brought to you in association with Rolex.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here is any second. It's going to be 8:42 here in London.
And it's nearly 7:42 in Bamako, which is where we're going to be heading next. Alex Duvall-Smith, our correspondent in Mali, joins us on the line. Alex, welcome to the program. Of course, we had presidential elections back on July the 28th, but after all that time, it still seems like the country still doesn't have a president.
Well, yes, we will be. We will be getting one. Mali will soon have a president. Preliminary results were given last week, and on Wednesday, yesterday, the Constitutional Court gave the final figures. So since last week, we've been waiting for some confirmation, and there's been no resumption of campaigning. Now, of course, campaigning will be able to resume because the Constitutional Court has spoken, and we're going straight into the Eid festivities, so it's not going to be very much politics in the run-up to Sunday's election. But on Sunday, there will be election. Out of the 27 candidates initially who were running, the last two were Ibrahim Boubacar Keita and Soumaila Cisse, so they'll be running off on Sunday. The other confirmation that came from the Constitutional Court yesterday was that the first round of the election had a very high turnout, 49%, which is a record in Mali. Interesting details like the fact that of those 49%, 400,000 of the ballots were spoiled, which means that they've basically been thrown away. Now, the Constitutional Court has brought some of those ballots back into the fold, but basically, to cut a long story short, lots of spoiled ballots because people in a country where many people are illiterate, unaccustomed to voting, and they had to use an ink pad to vote. So people would put their fingers on the ink pad and then point their finger on the photograph of the candidate they were voting for, but in fact they were supposed to put their fingerprint in the little square next to the candidate's face, and so lots of spoiled ballots by an unaccustomed electorate.
All systems have their weaknesses, don't they? But the question we're going to be asking is, can IBK go all the way?
Oh, yeah, that's got a nice ring to it, hasn't it?
Oh, yes. Has he thought of that? I can offer that.
If you ask me, I think he can. Having met both candidates and having seen them both on the hustings and their relationship with the crowds, IBK has got it where Somaila Cisse hasn't. Somaila Cisse is the kind of really impressive economist. He's worked in international institutions. He's run this country's finances for a short period with very little corruption and very well indeed. Probably singly thanks to him is why Mali had a reputation, a wrong reputation I would add, but a reputation for being a sort of model democracy. Well, it had a very responsible finance minister for some time, but he's just too sensible. You know, it's a bit like, would you vote for your headmaster? On one hand, you know, your headmaster would be really good at running the country, but maybe you'd just rather he ran the school. Whereas Ibrahim Boubacar Keita has oodles of charisma. He storms out on the stage in his crisp white gown and waves his arms about sort of Napoleonically. And I think that's what Mali wants at the moment. You know, it wants a strong leader, and it wants to feel that there's some greatness in this country.
And Alex, we heard from you saying some of those spoiled ballots there, but obviously before the run-up to the election, it was criticised, of course. We spoke about this on this very program, about it being too rushed, many people not being able to get their voting cards or being registered, refugees and people who were north weren't able to vote. Is that going to hang over the next president?
I think those details probably will be forgotten quite quickly because Mali's quite used to having very imperfect elections. But should this election have happened, I've probably come round to the view that yes, the country was being run by a transitional government and not an accountable one which was beginning to turn out quite a few contracts which were not going through a proper tender process. Now there's going to be an accountable government that the international community can do business with. Aid will be able to resume because aid's terribly important to get the economy going, to get confidence going again. And the only sort of danger is that the MNLA, the Tuareg separatist movement, who actually last night sent out a communique saying, right guys, we've been good during the election, but you still haven't released the political prisoners. You still have your part of the bargain to meet. And of course, the MNLA, as far as they're concerned, they want self-rule at the very least for Northern Mali. So lots and lots of challenges ahead for the president, but it's probably a good thing to have an elected president to deal with them.
Now, of course, Ramadan, as you mentioned before, has been on during this election period, and it's just coming to an end now. Does that mean we're going to get a flurry of last-minute campaigning? Because it sounds like Somaila Cisse could rather do with it if he's having to deal with IBK's overflowing charisma pot.
Well, yes, well, indeed, he could. But I heard this morning that Somaila Cisse has decided, because of the festivities, which actually the frantic eating starts today in Mali, he's decided not to do any rallies between now and Sunday. IBK, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, will do two, one today and one tomorrow. And then campaigning officially ends tomorrow evening. So, and really, to be perfectly honest, the Constitutional Court's announcement yesterday just about gave everyone time to finish their shopping, and then this morning they'll be doing all their cooking. Everyone's mind's on the party, not really on the political parties. and then campaigning has to stop on Friday evening because there's a sort of legal break of 24 hours before voting begins. So not going to see very much of the politicians until everyone goes back to polling stations on Sunday.
And of course, today does mark the first day of the Eid festivities. Are you going to be taking in the frantic eating as well, Alex?
Well, yes. Oh, you almost have to. I mean, interestingly enough, in Mali, I don't know how it goes in the rest of the world, but this is more of a beef-eating festival. Beef's not very expensive here. And when you're a European like me, you sort of assume that that's a luxury meat, but it's not. It's cheaper than sheep. And so whereas at the big Ramadan, at the big festivities of Ramadan, people will want to eat sheep, and if you're sort of well off, you will buy a whole sheep. What happens here is that colleagues at work or neighbours will all subscribe and buy a cow. So we actually will go to the supermarket, I think we'll be having a bit of a barbecue later today, yes.
Well, thanks very much indeed, Alex. That's Alex Duval-Smith, who will be having hers medium rare in Bamako.
Gotten a slightly hungry guy after that conversation with
funny?
Alex.
Isn't that funny how that sort of thing happens?
But imagine like if you just could go to the supermarket and buy a whole cow.
Mm.
That'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
Can you do that in Mali?
I don't think so, but maybe. Who knows? Well, we're going to stay in Mali now for some music this time. This is Sire Ture with Nisea Gandon. And that was Nisea Gandon by the Malian singer Sire Ture, which, as everyone knows in English, means "It is to you that I sing."
Isn't I never knew you were such an expert in
Thank
the local
you.
Languages.
I'm very good at African languages.
Excellent. Yeah. I'm pleased to
Alex,
hear
watch out. Alex Duval-Smith, that is. But we have another Alex here. Alex de Kramer. Hello, how are you?
Hi, good, how are you?
You're going to be looking through this morning's Turkish front pages, aren't you?
Yeah. So I'm starting off with Sözcü, which is on the nationalistic side a bit, the spokesman in English. They have this, today they have an exclusive interview with CHP leader Kılıçdaroğlu on the sledgehammer case, which has been ongoing, and on the 5th. This Monday.
You see, we've been calling it Ergenekon all this time.
Oh, good.
And now it turns out to be Sledgehammer, which
we can
is.
Keep on
it's,
calling
no, no, no. I like Sledgehammer a lot.
It's cool. So basically, he was talking about how the general staff of Turkey, İlker Başbuğ, who was the 26th chief of general staff of Turkey, he was originally hired by Erdogan, and he has all these documents. The right hand side of the page has this document that. Shows his progress. He has been sentenced for life imprisonment because he has been like considered the leader of this kind of deep state organization that's trying to throw the government over. But he's saying one day that perhaps Erdogan will be tried the same way because he's the name that kept on hiring him and giving him İlker Başbuğ promotions throughout his career.
And the verdict, of course, was a huge victory for Erdogan. And
yes.
We saw protests on Monday in front of the courthouse, people angry at that very verdict. But it doesn't seem like going on today, of course, is Thursday, that those protests have really continued. It's at least from the sense I'm getting, it seems that it's died off a bit.
Of course, because it's also Bayram, so everyone's going on holiday. So the timing is actually perfect. So since yesterday and since the beginning of this week, everyone's been just dispersing because it's the end of Eid and Ramadan.
Is the timing
holidays.
Coincidental
exactly.
Or has it been very carefully timed?
I think very carefully timed because already when the trial was going on, so the whole official holidays in Turkey started Wednesday and people didn't go to work Monday and Tuesday, obviously, because it makes more sense to have the entire week off. So
a good day to bury bad news.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone's on the beach reading it. Oh, yeah. There's nothing really is happening.
And you mentioned those holidays, the Bayram holidays. You've got an article here from the Cumhuriyet newspaper. It looks like the Radio and Television Supreme Council has sent out a few fines because of these ahead of these holidays.
Yes, so it's actually really funny. So during these Gezi protests, of course, we know we've been talking about this, that the Turkish channels haven't been streaming anything about Gezi Park. So there were two channels that actually did Halk TV, which is like a group of 30 people. They have like zero money themselves. People used to send them like YouTube videos that they streamed on the TV. Anyways, and they got five accounts, one of them, five fines, one of them being there was a 5 second of a cigarette and it's legally banned, so you can't have cigarettes shown on TV. Mm. And they got 365,000 liras fine.
So this is something which is, you know, presumably Verite broadcasting, right? It wasn't that they were trying to promote cigarettes or looking cool with them. It was just somebody happened to have a fag in their hand.
Exactly, exactly. And actually, they are fining the National Geographic streamed about drugs and drug usage. So it's kind of, it shows you how extreme they've gone in terms of censoring the media.
But you, so you talk about these fining these TV channels which apparently were supporting the Gezi Park movement. Is this a politically motivated thing, or is it strictly broadcasting regulations being applied?
I think it's a politically involved, obviously, fine. Because none of the channels, I think they just put National Geographic to show like, oh, it's an international channel. It's shown we're actually doing what the regulations are saying.
So National Geographic got dragged into it to legitimise the whole process.
Yeah.
And Alex, finally, let's move on to the Hurriyet newspaper. Let's talk about the Kamilika Mosque.
So Istanbul, yesterday Prime Minister Erdogan and our Environment Minister went to the opening, actually laid grounds for a mosque project in Istanbul, in Çamlıca area, which is going to host 37,500 people. And actually the Istanbul Chamber of Architects had filed a court case against this being built in that specific location, because already there are 14 religious projects going on around the area. And it's, again, a recurring theme that we are seeing, that it's like, demolishing the skyline of Istanbul.
It's fascinating stuff. And our Alijan he produced two very special editions of Section D, our design program, all about this very topic, about architecture's role in Istanbul. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Many thanks, Alex, for coming in for a flick through this morning's Turkish front pages. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denny, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Zoe Tennant, and of course, our very talented studio manager, Alex Funnel. Up next, after the news with David Spencer, is Culture with Robert Bound. I'll be back with Guy Delaney tomorrow morning at the same time for another edition of Midori House. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Guy Delaunay. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.